Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I would imagine it is every actor's dream to create a character that stays with audiences long after the play, the movie, or the TV show is a mere memory. William Shatner achieved that when he created Captain James T. Kirk, commanding officer of the starship USS Enterprise.
Where to, Captain?
Auxiliary Control, my Vulcan friend. This ship is off course.
The first episode of Star Trek came along in 1966 and ran for three seasons, but soon became a cult classic, later spawning sequels and spin-offs and a series of movies in which William Shatner reprised his role.
Travel forward with us, 300 years into the future, to confront the greatest mystery ever to threaten mankind. We are aboard a huge starship called the Enterprise. This is the return of Captain Kirk.
An alien object of unbelievable destructive power is less than 3 days away from this planet.
But he also had notable successes with other projects, including the highly entertaining, if quirky, TV show Boston Legal.
Value of human life. It's a bugger.
In addition to acting, he is an author. He's recorded albums.
Not the man they think I am. No. I'm a rocket man. Burning out his fuse out here alone.
He worked with Neil deGrasse Tyson on an audio project called Cosmos Confidential. And who better for that, considering he's actually been to space, and at the age of 95... he continues to ride horses, recently undergoing surgery for a riding accident. And on April 17th, William Shatner will be in Charlotte to conduct a Q&A at Ovens Auditorium following a screening of the film Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. And in advance of that, we spoke with William Shatner a few weeks ago, and we started with that topic I mentioned a moment ago, and it may surprise some of you, his love of horses. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for doing this afternoon.
Oh, thank you for asking me to be here.
I just scratched the surface of your professional accomplishments, which I want to talk about. But first, I want to ask how you are, because I said that you just had a horseback riding accident. How are you?
I came off a horse some years ago, landed on my shoulder, and it deteriorated then and became arthritic, so to the point where, you know, I didn't use it much, and it was painful to the touch and lying on it. But I'd given up on it. You know, at a certain age, you don't want to go under the knife because you don't know what's going to happen. But a friend of mine, who's a bone doctor, said to me, Bill, there's a new invention. Somebody, either in Austria or Australia, invented a reverse, and then there's a couple of words after that, where the ball goes in the socket goes in the ball, and you're in and you're out in the same day. You can be.
Wow.
A joint replacement. And if you want to do it, I, Dr. Clapper, will do it, because I've done hundreds of them. And I said, Rob, if you can do it for me, great. A few days ago, 4 days ago, I was under the knife. I was out the same day. There was a huge sling, but I had to go to work. I had to fly, you know, 3,000 miles of this thing. And I said, do I need this? And he said, yeah, get rid of the sling. And I went without a sling. Hours after this operation, I did my entertaining thing. Came back Saturday night, slept very well on Sunday, and here we are recording this on Monday, and it's been 5 days.
Wow.
Since I had this operation.
That's Star Trek medicine.
And it's a miracle. It's the miracle of modern science, my muscles are tight from disuse, but in a while, I'll be able to hold the reins in my left hand and do my my reigning horse competition, which is very athletic horse competition.
I read this about what you do on that horse, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I've seen this on television, I think. Is this where you the horse runs really quickly and you rein it in and it slides to a finish? Is that what's going on here?
That's the start, usually the start. Usually, and there are various starts. So one pattern is you run through the gate to the far end of the auditorium arena, and you slide to a stop. If the horse is a good slider, you may go 30, 40 feet, sliding on his skates, sliding on his rear legs, comes to a stop. Now, all this is done like to a pattern and musically, not to music, but to a rhythm. Left turn, he can't take a step. He turns on, he pivots on his rear end, and now at a canter, leaves that spot, runs down to the other end of the, and slides to a stop, repeats it there, turns around, slides to a stop in the center, backs up, but with precision, stops. Four turns to the right, stop. Four and a quarter turns to the left, now you're facing the judges. To your right on this pattern, a fast turn, then you slow to a very slow turn, then a fast turn and change leads. A horse is going to the right, is on a right lead, changes to a left lead, goes to the left, circle to the left, fast, slow, fast again, changes again, goes to the top of the arena and slides to a stop at the far end. And I've forgotten something in that pattern, which is
then. I was going to ask you how the horse learns to do that, but how did you learn to do that? Because you're in control, I would take it.
Practice. The extraordinary talents of the horse trainers, that's where AI can't come in.
Right.
A horse trainer who will tell you time and again he doesn't get paid enough is this master of horse behavior and conditions the horse. And gradually the horse says, oh, is this what you want me to do? And you can see the horse suddenly say, hey, this is fun, and slides because it's fun and everything else. The horse that is recalcitrant swishes his tail, lays his ears back, and isn't happy doing it. You can't win on a horse like that.
You're coming to town to Charlotte in April 17th to take questions following a screening of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. You have played so many different parts in your career, and I want to talk about that going through the next few minutes here. But you're kind of like a singer with a number one hit record. Every time that singer goes out, they have to sing their hit. And you have to be Captain Kirk a lot in your life. But, I mean, is it a blessing or a curse?
Well, it's a blessing in that they're asking me to come to your theater and get people in to sit down and see a movie I'm in and listen to me talk and try and amuse people. That's difficult to do in this age, and I'm being asked to do it because people will come. And people will come, I think, based on a body of work, but certainly the body was brought to life by Star Trek. Yeah. Was inseminated by Star Trek.
You know, people don't remember this, but when Star Trek first premiered, I think it was 1960. Help me out.
Seven,
something like that. On NBC, it was not the success that it has become. In fact, they canceled it after three seasons. It was a 5-year mission that they canceled after three seasons.
All right,
and somehow it was discovered in reruns, and the rest is history. How do you explain the popularity of Star Trek? It's amazingly popular. I love it.
It is amazing.
I've watched every iteration.
You know, I just finished an old book. Perhaps you read it when it was more popular. The Kid Stays in the Picture. Do you remember that book? Anyway, I just finished it. And his experience of making movies is so tawdry is so ugly. So many ugly things happened to this guy who wrote the book. But I can't imagine why he would stay in it for money, as he points out for time again. But why would anybody spend a lifetime doing something that you never knew was going to stab you in the back? Never knew. He was arrested. He was charged with murder. All because he was making movies. It's a bizarre book from a filmmaker like me. Like, why would you continue to do that? Making movies is fun. Making movies is fun. And if it isn't fun by the second time you're making your second movie, I don't know why you're there, because it can be ugly. It's filled with people who are jealous, people who are envious, people who want what you have, people who want to destroy you because that makes next in line. It's filled with people like that. But it's also filled with people who won the Academy Awards. It's filled with people who love to make films. It's people who are generous and loving and talented. Talented. Making movies, inventing new ideas and new concepts. And, you know, you talk about science fiction, and you see the advent of technology in movies and the things they can, that a person comes out of their imagination, and where does things that fly and the things that explode and the things that envelop, where does that come from? Where does that imagination come from? It comes from, obviously, your brain, but it comes from a joy of creation. Like, hey, I can do this. So instead of a flashlight in the turret of the Enterprise, when they were filming the Enterprise, they have these incredible vehicles that is a product of somebody's mind that hasn't been invented and won't be invented for 400 years. Making movies can be fun.
A lot of the things that science fiction has, and science fiction writers and directors have created, have come to be true. I mean, these cell phones that we have are very much
exactly,
like the communicators.
Exactly. I gave that thing to some character in Star Trek, and when I was in Cleveland after Star Trek had been canceled, Motorola had invented something like that, and I flipped it open to use the phone, and a crowd collected around me. I thought, what the heck are they? And it was the phone that looked like the, whatever we called that thing.
The communicator. And you knew one of those creators, Gene Roddenberry. He's the guy who created the whole zeitgeist.
Well,
started.
Yes and no. Gene started the idea, but the people he hired, the engineers, the creators, those were the real working people that made, and the people who wrote the scripts. There was an army. Small army, but a very productive army of people that fashioned Star Trek.
William Shatner, Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise. He'll be taking questions following a screening of the movie Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan Friday night at Ovens Auditorium. We have more from my conversation with William Shatner coming up. That's right after this quick break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with William Shatner, Captain James T. Kirk from Star Trek fame, and many other roles on television and in the movies.
I now arrive in New York. I'm an unemployed actor. I've been in a Marlowe play on Broadway. Agents notice me, want to represent me. So now I've got representation. I've got a wife and a new baby living in Queens in New York City, and I'm looking for work. And I get a job here and I get a job there, but I got to pay the rent. So you want to hire me? Great. You need a young actor doing something? Hey, here I am. The actors of my generation were on all these half-hour shows. they paid, you know, several hundred dollars. You do one a month. Hey, you're several hundred dollars. You're paying the rent. You're feeding the baby. You can make the subway.
I have to ask you about this because I really didn't know this about you until yesterday, and I hope that it's true, because a long time ago, I spoke for about 20 minutes to Buffalo Bob, who was the kingpin of the Howdy Doody show. This is back in the 50s, and you were Ranger Bob on the Howdy Doody show for a while. Is
See,
that right?
I have no recollection. I've been told that. recollection of that whatsoever. The guy said, no, that's a lie. I've never been. But if Buffalo Bob says I was there, I guess I was there. But part of the hysteria of getting on a subway from Queens and making it downtown New York and walking the streets, and it's hot, and I got to get that job, and I got, what was that line? There's an anxiety going on right now in New York and where I am. Even more so where I am, because jobs are disappearing here.
Right.
People are out of work. So there's a deep anxiety about existence. Mm. How do I pay the rent when there's AI going on around, or no AI and nothing? There's a change going on. There's a revolution going on right now that people... out of work. I mean, it's awful everywhere.
And you know, all these oligarchs who are pushing AI because there's money to be made, but there's only money to be made to a certain point, because if
nobody
has...
Yeah, but listen to me, Mike. Listen to me. In all fairness, you can't restrain progression. You can't restrain invention. Artificial intelligence may be the savior of humankind. May be finding, they are finding medical reasons to stop any of these diseases, making us live longer, making us live more easily. AI can be the expression of human eternity. Mankind can live for a long time based on AI to come. AI may be the answer to humanity's progression into the future. Or you and I will never speak again.
Well, we have to figure out how to invent the Star Trek economy where money isn't necessary.
But it isn't necessarily money that they're doing. Yeah. I know it is money. They're buying their way into it.
Right.
But it's also being invented. There's progression. And quantum, for me, the quantum is the magic cloud in front of us.
You know, I spoke with Neil deGrasse Tyson a couple of weeks ago on this
program. By the way, we're working on a show together. We did a book, we did a show, and we're planning to do two shows in New York.
That's why I brought it up, because this is the kind of thing I'm imagining that you're talking with him about, because you seem to have interest in a lot of different things. What the show is called, the project is called Cosmos Confidential, Bill and Neil's Excellent Bromance, an unscripted, wide-ranging conversation on everything. How did this come about? How did this come about?
I'm trying to remember. So there was a cruise ship going somewhere exotic. And they hired me to entertain at night. So I would do something at night that was entertaining. And so they hired Neil to do the same thing. So as the evenings passed by, I don't remember how it occurred, but we sat on the same chairs, on the same stage, and had these heated discussions about whatever. I, the barbarian at the gate, knew nothing, talking to a giant intellect, at least we like to think so. So I would ask the questions and say, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. And sometimes it didn't make any sense. And I'd rile him up, and we'd have these arguments that I, representing every man who knew nothing, was talking to a guy who knew a great deal, especially about space. And that was the interesting factor. So I'd ask these savage questions with passion, and he would regale me with information.
You are among the 600 people, human beings, who have been in space. You've done something I've always wanted to do, and I'll never do it, but that's okay. But you were on board the Blue Origin NS-18, and I recall that you did an interview right after you got out of the capsule. And in that interview, you were very emotional. Talk about that experience and what it felt like and what it meant to you.
Mike, as you can imagine, I've been asked to do this with some frequency, and I can expound on it, from Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, and 60 years ago, and being affected by that, and realizing more and more as I became aware of the destruction that mankind is venturing onto the earth in every form, ending up with, a great invention, plastic. We got plastic, man. That's the new thing. We don't have to cut down the trees, and we got microbes that'll eat it, and it was great. And you and I are filled with microplastics floating around in our blood. I have a friend of mine who thinks it's affected his prostate and all. I mean, there is debris floating in our blood system, in the blood going round and round, and it's not being eliminated. And not only is it not being eliminated, we're drinking water out of a bottle. This isn't on television, but here's a bottle of water, which I'm going to consume, which has microplastics in it. And I'm being told by doctors, don't drink water out of a plastic bottle. And so try and find a glass bottle, and then try not to break it so it shatters on the kitchen floor. We're destroying our environment. The older I get, the more I face death and realize what the sadness of passing. The sadness of passing is not only my kids and my wife and my dogs and my horses, but even more than that, me, something that takes an even bigger role is the gorgeousness of nature. I'm looking out, talking to you, I'm looking out at a window in the San Fernando Valley. I've got mountains and greens. Everything is green here. It's a lovely winter day in Los Angeles, and I've got water filled with plastics. I've had an egg sandwich. My dogs are around, but they're quiet because I'm surrounded by the beauty, the gorgeousness of nature, of the natural world. And if only we were aware all the time, Mike, of how beautiful it is, how beautifully it operates. I went in for a shoulder operation. The gorgeousness of our body and how it works, and the miracle of how it works. How did it evolve? How did a ball and socket evolve, for crying out loud?
Let me just finish the sentence. Okay, sure.
We need to be aware of how gorgeous this is and how we're destroying it. Okay, I can continue about Voyage in Space, but please, I'll let you into your own show.
Well, no, I have to ask if you've always been this way, because on March 22nd, you turned 95. You're full of energy.
I have not been this way. Being this way is evolution. When you're in your 1 to 10, you're mommy, what's to eat? Johnny won't play with me. 10 to 30, next passage, 10 to 20, 10 to 30, your passage is filled with, I gotta get, like we were talking about being in New York, whatever, how am I gonna, I got these responsibilities, I gotta be successful, I gotta cross the street, I gotta. Around 30, 35, look around you and say, well, wait a minute. Why is that guy voting for that? And now you're 40, 45, 50. Maybe I'm past the middle line. I could die at any moment. Oh, my God. Do you realize the trees talk to each other, that they send electrochemical signals to each other. Oh my God, I didn't know that. Do you realize that? And then you're beginning to see the magic of nature and the delicacy and the profundity of nature. As you grow older, you begin to see the world, if you're aware and not still filled with, oh my God, I'm a billionaire and I've got to own that company. If you're aware of what's around you, you begin to relish the fingernails. Oh my God, look at that, my fingernails, I need cutting. And it takes age and like wine.
But you have the enthusiasm and the energy of somebody who's 30. How do you explain that? I mean, it's remarkable.
I don't know, and I've been told that, and I don't know. All I know is the passions that are in me for everything, for the beauty of a horse, for the love of a dog, for the arms around from children and loved ones. It's precious. And my awareness of it is totally emotional. When I was sobbing outside that spaceship, saying, I don't want to forget what I'm feeling. And I'm crying on national television thinking, what the heck am I doing? Why am I? I go into a corner and I realize I'm grieving for the planet. We're killing the planet and we're kicking it down. Oh, no, it doesn't exist. What do you mean it doesn't exist? Are you blind? We're fighting for our life. You don't suddenly say, you get phlegmatic. Oh, yeah, point the knife at my throat. Get away from me.
Right.
You're killing me and my loved ones. That's the passion you have to have to make it work, because that means you got to go without or do less. My voice is leaving me slowly.
Tell me what it was like for you to be up there for the few minutes that you were in
space. I'm going to give
you
the picture. Okay. As I pass by the spaceship, on my way to the gantry to walk up 11 flights, and the gantry's at 4,500 feet. I'm at altitude and I'm already breathless. I kind of go up a little. Pass by a valve and it's hissing. They call it bleeding. What's it bleeding? Hydrogen. It's what? Yeah, no, we fill the spaceship with hydrogen and that catches fire and, you know, the energy. Well, wait a minute. Did you guys ever watch the documentary on the Hindenburg?
Hindenburg, yeah.
You remember that? Oh, the humanity of it, and people in black are running from the flame, and the whole thing's on fire. You know what was burning?
Hydrogen.
Yeah. And you know how it happened? They docked with the landing cord. The tie-off rope. Static electricity went up the rope. They had anodized the body of the Hindenburg. They'd put a film of, I think it was aluminum, to retain whatever. Either keep the rays away or keep the rays in. At the very end, and they had bags of hydrogen tied off. At the very end of the hydrogen, it was a couple of bags of hydrogen that were slowly leaking. And the static electricity flew across the anodized body of the Hindenburg and sparked those bags. Those bags exploded, lit everything else up, and the thing exploded. And that's what's in the spaceship that I'm going on.
That's right. You're riding on top of a bomb.
You're riding on top of a bomb. And we've seen them explode. I go, oh, geez, I never thought of that. Now I got to climb, fly 11 flights up and get it. I lie down on the spin thing. You know, we've been there a couple of days rehearsing how to get in and out of the seat when you're in weightlessness. And I'm thinking, my God, this thing could explode. Now, they said, you know, if anything happens, the spaceship will jump away. So I'm waiting for it to jump away, and I hear the voiceover guy saying, countdown, 17, 16, 15, hold it, there's an anomaly. Anomaly, I remember. Yeah, anomaly means, you know, it shouldn't be there. What show? Okay, we're continuing the countdown. Countdown 17, 16, 15. This is verbatim. 14, 13. All right, everybody. We're going to remove the gantry, and this is God's truth. If anybody wants to get off, they should get off now. Because I didn't get off. I got out into space and saw all the things we've talked about. I see the blackness of space and death, and I that feeling of loss, of sadness, of grief hits me. And when I get off the spaceship, I'm weeping because I'm in mourning for our planet.
William Shatner, Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise. He'll be taking questions following a screening of the movie Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan Friday night at Ovens Auditorium. As you could likely tell from my conversation with William Shatner, he's clearly passionate about the Earth, how we treat our planet, and the consequences that come from that treatment. That's also in the minds of the experts that will join WFAE tomorrow for our Carolinas Climate Summit. It's a day when we hear from climate experts, community leaders, and advocates who are exploring the impact of climate change in the Carolinas and how people at every level are addressing it. David Neal is one of those experts. He is senior attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center. He will be interviewed at tomorrow's summit by WFAE's Nick Della Canal. But before that, he spoke to us about the promise and the pitfalls of technology and climate solutions. That conversation is coming up after this break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. As you could likely tell from my conversation with William Shatner, he's clearly passionate about the Earth, how we treat our planet, and the consequences that come from that treatment. That's also on the minds of the experts that will join WFAE tomorrow for our Carolinas Climate Summit at the UNC Charlotte's Du Bois Center uptown. It's a day where we hear from climate experts, community leaders, and advocates who are exploring the impact of climate change in the Carolinas and how people at every level are addressing it. David Neal is one of those experts. He is senior attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center. He'll be interviewed at tomorrow's summit by WFAE's Nick Della Canal. But before that, he spoke to us about the promise and the pitfalls of technology on climate solutions. Thank you for being here. Climate change is a major concern for environmentalists. As the New York Times reports, Lee Zeldin, who is the head of Trump's Environmental Protection Agency, appears to be speaking now more frequently and forcefully about supporting industry and exporting fossil fuels than protecting the environment. Their analysis, the Times analysis, shows that Zeldin talks more about the environment, the economy rather, and less about pollution. He talks more about American energy than public health, more about energy dominance than energy efficiency, more about cutting red tape than concerns about global warming. So is this new approach neutering any activism that you or others with environmental concerns might engage in?
Not at all. I think it's a misguided effort by this administration to prop up a dying industry. Their efforts to prop up coal plants that were otherwise slated to close because they were uneconomic, because they were costing customers too much money for the value they were producing, is a futile exercise. I mean, if we want to talk about energy dominance, we need to be talking about the leading sources of new generation that are added to our grid every year. And that's far and away solar, battery storage, and wind for the last few years have made up upwards of 80, 90% of all new generating capacity added to our grid. You don't have to look further than Texas to see a state that's doing that purely for economic reasons, not driven by climate policy, not driven by any environmental concerns. It's just the fastest, most economical resources to add to the grid.
One of the things you'll be concentrating on at the climate summit tomorrow is these well, AI, I guess, to a degree, but the data centers that power artificial intelligence. It's becoming a focus of increased discussions here and around the country. The Southern Environmental Law Center, in cooperation with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, is now involved in a lawsuit in Stokes County Superior Court over a proposed data center there. This is a 2,000-acre parcel along the Dan River. What are your concerns about that project on that site?
I'm not involved in that case specifically. I know generally that there's a lot of concerns around land use, around the public participation, and some failures in the local zoning process. I think more broadly, our concern around data centers is how they're driving some of Duke Energy's resource decisions. If you look at what's in Duke's resource plan, its carbon plan, a lot of the future load growth that they say they need to build a lot of new gas plants to meet is coming from large new loads like data centers. And yet we're really concerned, and not just us, the public staff, some other key interveners, the Attorney General's office, are concerned that Duke's including in that forecast a lot of speculative projects that very likely won't come to market. If you allow the utility to build new infrastructure, new power plants to meet that speculative load, there's a real risk that that's just going to fall on all the other ratepayers to pay for. And so we have to be really careful. We have to scrutinize that load. We have to scrutinize those projects and make sure that they're really viable and they're not just speculative projects too. And I think there's some concern around those data centers that, you know, they're really trying to tap into this boom, but maybe aren't really going to be that beneficial to their local communities.
And that's one of the concerns I get about, particularly, well, let's talk about this. As I understand it, the United States is home to the most data centers in the world. Virginia is the data center capital of the world. But the Southeast seems to be the place that's attracting a lot of these data centers. And maybe that speaks to what you were just talking about, because as I understand it, Southern utilities are usually monopolies. They're not privately operated. And they make a return on infrastructure investments. So if they promise to build something to power these data centers, but the data center doesn't arrive for whatever reason, we're still on the hook as ratepayers. Is that what you're saying?
That's absolutely right. We have some skewed incentives in our utility business model. They were put in place for a good reason back when we were electrifying. Back when utilities were first getting started, it made sense to incentivize them to build the infrastructure they needed to serve customers. But what we found in the last 10 or 15 years, when there wasn't rising demand for electricity, it meant these utilities that earned their profits for shareholders based on the amount of infrastructure they could build had, you know, we see a mismatch between what it is we need the utilities to do and what their business model directs them to do. So yes, it means regulators and the public have to really scrutinize their plans and make sure they're not overbuilding their system.
And it is kind of ironic that this new technology, these data centers that power AI, are beginning to increasingly rely on older forms of power generation, because Duke is not alone in this. Other power companies are saying they need to do this now, and therefore they need to keep coal plants online longer. They need to bring in more natural gas plants. They're not talking about more nuclear necessarily, and they're not talking about cleaner sources of power like solar or wind. Why not?
It's a real concern. I mean, we do not want the technology of the future to be fueled with the energy sources of the past. And it's notable that a lot of these technology companies that are building that AI infrastructure have clean energy goals. They have climate goals. And it makes sense to try to meet those companies where they are and to build the energy resources, the carbon-free energy resources that they're looking for their data centers. It is true that Duke includes nuclear in its long-range plans, but what we've noticed is every 2 years, those future advanced nuclear plants are another 2 years in the future. So it's perpetually 10 or 12 years into the future. And they are planning to build solar and battery storage, but not at the scale and pace that we think really that the moment calls for.
I don't know whether you can answer this question because you're not necessarily an energy company economist, but it seems to me that once you put up a solar array, the power you generate from it is free. Once you put up wind power, the power that comes from the wind when the wind is blowing is free. When you store it in a battery that's from those sources, it's there and it hasn't cost you anything, but the infrastructure to make that power capturable and storable. Coal costs money. Natural gas costs money. Why would they turn their backs on that or not? Why wouldn't they be embracing this more quickly?
Yeah, it is. You've hit on one of the key concerns we have about Duke's resource plan, which is putting so much emphasis on new gas plants. And with that comes the need to build new gas infrastructure to fuel those plants. So what Duke is asking its customers to pay for is not just the new combined cycle plants or the new combustion turbines, but the additional pipeline infrastructure. Ultimately, customers will have to pay for that as well. And they have these fixed costs on top of that for what's called firm transportation. And they're even looking at building their own LNG facilities, liquefied natural gas facilities to store the gas, which would be another enormous expense for customers. And you add on top of that the volatility of those fuel costs. And we saw this when Russia invaded Ukraine. We are likely to see it again with the instability in the Middle East, mm-hmm. because a lot more of our domestic gas is being converted to LNG and being shipped to Europe or Asia. That puts more of our gas on track to meet higher world prices. So that's going to be another factor that increases cost for customers. So we're really worried about over-reliance on gas hitting customers multiple ways, both from the construction costs and those fuel costs.
Yes, you've said that these escalating fuel costs will make it harder to reach. Will also make it harder. Just using these fuels will make it harder to reach our 2050 carbon neutrality requirement. And the governor says, Governor Josh Stein says, that Duke has retreated from the state's clean energy future. Would you agree with that statement?
I think, yes. I mean, you look at the gas plants that Duke plans to build into the 2030s, into the 2040s. These are 35-year assets. There's no way to economically make the case for building those long-lived fossil fuel assets if at 2050 you have to hit net zero. The placeholder in Duke's plan for that is to use green hydrogen. There are a lot of problems with that, most notably cost and the lack of the existing infrastructure to power them with hydrogen. So that's a really big asterisk in Duke's plan that deserves a lot more scrutiny.
So these data centers they're a fact. They're not going away. AI is a fact. It's not going away. In fact, the opposite is true. It's racing through our bloodstream like a bad virus. We'll see what happens as a result of that. But opponents of these centers say repeatedly that they can adversely impact nearby residents' health. It's not just the fact that we're talking about fossil fuel production of the electricity needed to power them. It's the fact that there's a mixture of air pollution, noise pollution, and water pollution, as well as heat pollution. They have heat impacts, which all can combine to worsen asthma and cardiovascular disease for those living in the vicinity. That's what's alleged. For someone not familiar with what these data centers are, how big they are, why do they generate these kinds of pollutants?
I think the concern around air pollution is mostly tied to their use of diesel generators as backup. And what we've seen in some instances is we've had the challenge in Memphis, for example, when Elon Musk's company was powering a data center using gas turbines just on the back of tractor trailers, which didn't have the permits for, largely. So we're emitting a lot of local air pollution in an area that already faces a disproportionate amount of harmful air pollution. So for some of these data centers that are rushing to market before they have grid electricity, that there's a real concern they're going to be burning diesel or gas on site to power them or to supplement their power, and that's going to cause significant air pollution concerns.
So is it emergency backup? Is it emergency backup power, or is it supplemental power adding to what they're already getting from the grid?
And we've seen both. I mean, again, the example in Memphis with the Grok data center was, instead of getting connected to the grid, was just hooking up these turbines on site and burning fuel on site to power it. So we've seen both, it both as a backup power source and as a primary power source.
These centers also use millions of gallons of water, and some of that is expelled into rivers and streams, and it's expelled at a temperature higher than it was when they took that water in. And I'm just curious as to why they can't use a closed loop system. Why do they have to continually extract water and then push it back into rivers at a higher temperature? Why?
They can use closed loop systems, and we increasingly hope that that will be what the newer data centers rely on, both to use less water, but also to avoid those concerns. So that is an existing technology. That is something they can do. And again, we're hoping will become the norm.
One complaint about the emergence of these data centers around the country is that they're often located with little input from citizens in the surrounding area. And when those citizens go looking for details on the specs, what they'll actually do and how they will actually hurt the environment or change the environment or whatever, that's often shrouded behind non-disclosure agreements. Why does this appear to be a repeating pattern? It makes the whole thing look very suspicious, even if it's not.
It's a great question. I think it's an industry that I think is always looking for a competitive advantage. And my guess is that they don't want to tip their hand to competitors, but it's not good for local government to have these large, you know, these large facilities that are going to have a big impact on the communities. There really should be a transparent process ahead of any approvals for those. So we certainly would be against having any kind of local planning decisions that are shrouded in secrecy.
Yeah. One of your colleagues at the Southern Environmental Law Center, Christina Libre, also says that a lot of the proposed data centers that are on the drawing board today will never be built. And our communities are going to ultimately pay the price for these gas plants and pipelines that are going to be installed now for something that will never exist. Why is that the case?
Well, again, this is it's a rapidly growing industry. There's a lot of speculation, and I think some of these data centers are shopping around, and so they're saying to Duke, "We'd like to build a facility here," but they're also saying that to a utility in Missouri or Texas. So, until we get more certainty, until those are locked in with solid contracts where they have financial commitments to pay for the infrastructure that would be used to serve them, it shouldn't be in the load forecast, and it shouldn't be something that Duke is planning to serve.
You can hear more discussion on this and other topics from our guest, David Neal, senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center, tomorrow at WFAE's Climate Summit at UNC Charlotte's Dubois Center Uptown. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest David Neal will be speaking tomorrow with WFAE's Nick Della Canal at our Climate Summit, our annual Climate Summit, which will be at the Dubois Center at the UNC Charlotte Uptown campus. And then on Friday, William Shatner, our other guest, will be taking questions and answers following a screening of the Star Trek movie The Wrath of Khan at Ovens Auditorium.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.